Subcommittee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Family Justice, Friday, February 22nd, 1991, 2 p.m., hearing room 354, public hearing and work session.
Our agenda today includes House Bill 2397, 2415, 2405, all of which are public hearing, possible work session, and work session on House Bill 2395. It is the intention of the chair to have us out of here, if possible, by 4:30, especially since it's a Friday. I know that some members have to travel quite a distance to be with their families on the weekends. I think we will go in the following order. I think we will start with House Bill 2397. Then I think we will go into work session on House Bill 2395, and then come back and hear our first set of testimony on House Bill 2415 and 2405. So we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2397. And counsel, would you give us an overview, please, of House Bill 2397?
Yes.
And while you're doing that,
well, I'm catching my breath.
I'm going to ask
history. What's our history lesson?
Ask Mr. Paul Drews to come up while counsel's giving us an overview on House Bill 2397.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for those of you who were members of the 1989 legislature, you will, this bill should look familiar. It was last session, it was Senate Bill 697. At that time, there was an obligation imposed upon individuals who have a duty to report under Oregon's child abuse laws, which are listed at 418.750, to be notified every 2 years of their duty to report, and to also be trained or receive training in the areas that are necessary to investigate child abuse reports. At the request of the task force, what this bill does is require that evidence be produced or documentation be produced that, in fact, the individuals who are have to report or receive this training have, in fact, done it. I would point out that the summary of the bill is very misleading in that it says it requires mandated reporters to receive training on legal, medical, and psychological aspects of child sexual abuse. In fact, that's what the legislature did last session, and this bill just requires that that they produce evidence. There is some confusion in the bill that was pointed out to me, and I think it's a legitimate concern. There was much discussion last session, you might recall, about who should be reporting and what kind of training there ought to be and that kind of stuff. When you look at the new language, it says the Oregon State Bar and each board that licensed, certifies, or registered public or private officials shall require evidence. And then it goes on to say if the bar or board enforces a mandatory continuing education program for renewal, it shall include such training as a part of its continuing education requirement. For those that are not licensed, certified, or registered, the training shall be provided by their employer through CSD. Well, there are some groups who have non-mandatory continuing education requirements, but who are, in fact, licensed, registered, and certified, i.e. the physicians. So there's at least one point that needs clarifying in the bill. And I think that's it.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Drews, would ask you to give us your testimony on House Bill 2397 and to take questions as well. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Clark, members of the committee. I'm Paul Drews, Acting Assistant Administrator for Child Protective Services of the Children's Services Division. I'm here to support the concept that this bill is based on. I think it's important that people who are already named in the law as mandatory reporters should receive training. You have my written testimony in front of you. I'll just briefly summarize that there are two main points that we think make this a good bill. One is the children who are victimized. This will increase our ability, presumably if people are well trained to recognize the children are being abused, increase our ability to intervene and provide appropriate services in those cases. And hopefully break the cycle of abuse, because every study that we have seen indicates that a majority of adult perpetrators of abuse were abused as children. Second major reason that we think it's important is hopefully we can provide earlier intervention if we have better trained people reporting to us. There is a fiscal impact attached. I think you have a copy of that. You don't have a copy of that in your package. Okay. I don't have 15 copies of that. I'm sorry. I thought you would have it. Our estimate is that it would cost approximately $90,000 a biennium for CSD, but I want to clarify that that estimate is based on our reading of the law, which says that we would only be responsible for training a portion of the mandatory reporters. You need to know that I did a little study last session when you were dealing with a similar bill, and if you add up approximate figures for all mandatory reporters, we're talking about approximately 120,000 people in this state.
Mr. Drews, we've got already some confusion up here. I'm going to stop you, and
okay.
The chair shares Representative Edmondson's confusion, and we're not convinced, and we need to talk right up front about what the bill does. Does it require training that is not now required under Oregon law? My reading of it is that it does.
My reading is also that it does.
Okay. But that may or may not be a good idea, but I think we need to understand that right up front.
Yes, I think what was passed last session is a more general provision for making sure that information, that CSD had information that was available to distribute to mandatory reporters. This is much more specific. It talks about the legal, psychological, medical aspects of sexual abuse specifically.
Thank you, Representative Edmondson.
Well, that, thank you, Mr. Chair. Subsections 1 and 4 of 418.749 require CSD to implement training and continuing education, and 4, develop and make available at cost training materials. Now, my question is twofold. First, is CSD doing that? And second, your $90,000 figure, does that include this sort of training program, or is that just for the additional training? And which I guess implicit in that is, what's it costing you to do what the law requires you to do now?
Chair Clark, Representative Edmondson, on the basis of what was passed last session, we developed these flyers, and I have copies of these if everybody in the committee would like them. We developed a flyer that is a two-sided, one page, that is available, for example, to the Board of Nursing or to the OMA or to the bar, that they can either at cost ask us to provide them with enough to mail out to everybody that they license or certify, or we can send them a single copy and they can make their own and send them out. So that's available. In addition, we developed an approximately 80-page mandatory reporter curriculum, which is also available at cost. These cost about $1.75 apiece plus mailing costs, and our information that we sent to all the boards that license and register and certify was they could go either route on that. We'll send them a free copy, they can make their own, or we'll do them at cost for them. We were not funded for, and have not been asked at this point, to provide staff to go out and do what we estimated would be approximately a 3 to 4 hour training. This is not specifically on sexual abuse, as the new language calls for. This is on all aspects of child abuse, and it's written at a much, what I would describe as in less depth than what I think this language requires.
Thank you.
Okay, then to your second question, our estimate of approximately $90,000 a biennium, it's not in my written testimony, but I wanted to clarify that as I read the proposed language here, we would not be responsible for training nurses, doctors, lawyers, all of those professionals who are licensed or certified, the board that does that to them would be the ones that were responsible. So what we tried to do was estimate who are the people who don't fall in those categories, and primarily we came up with other DHR division employees who, because of the nature of their employment, would be required to report child abuse. And so it's a very small number of that approximately 120,000 mandatory reporters that we're projecting having to train. If I'm misreading that law, then the fiscal impact's going to be a lot higher.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
In regard to this new bold-faced language that we're proposing in this bill, should we limit the requirement of evidence of training to child sexual abuse, or should we more generalize it to child abuse, assuming that, or make it child sexual abuse and child abuse, the idea being that get them to provide evidence of both kinds of training rather than limited training?
Chair Clark, Representative Mannix, my preference, if the money were available, would be to make it broader and cover all issues of child abuse. I think it is written the way it is because it came out of the Task Force on Sexual Offenses Against Children, and so that was their focus.
Can I follow up on that?
Representative Mannix.
Is your financial impact, your fiscal impact, going to be much different if we broadened it a bit?
Chair Clark, Representative Mannix, it would not be for us if I'm reading the law correctly, and that is that we would only be responsible for training other DHR employees.
I think you're reading it correctly. We can state that on the record and make that clear, too. Maybe someone else will disagree with my interpretation.
Mr. Drews, remind the committee, if you would, please, who currently are reporters, required reporters?
I can give you some examples. All attorneys are listed in the law, all doctors, all school personnel, all...
Okay, you've said enough. So you've got corporate lawyers, you've got dermatologists, you've got folks who, the statute now says, if you are aware of child abuse, you must report it, which is okay, I suppose, because the folks who don't ever come into contact with kids, for example, the corporate lawyers or the tax lawyers or the brain surgeon or someone, it's just simply not going to apply very often, if ever. This bill says, we don't care about that. You're going to receive training in abuse.
It does. I read it the same way you do, Chair Clark. And in some of the discussion that was held last session when a similar bill was introduced, that is one of the points that was made, for example, by both the Bar Association and the Oregon Medical Association, which I agreed with. They pointed out that there are attorneys who never come into contact with a child in the course of their employment. If you'll notice, in the language that's being proposed this year, those portion of mandatory reporters that CSD would train, on line 31, starting on line 31, through the Children's Services Division, if the contact with child sexual abuse situations is within the scope of their employment. So there was an effort to put a limit there, but there was no effort on the others. And I think that's a point well taken. See,
all of this gets back to one of my pet peeves, which we ought to be specializing, certifying specialties in the law. That way you could say anybody that, but that's another battle for another day. All right, further questions for Mr. Drews? Counsel, do you have a question, or are you just kind of mumbling to yourself?
I'm just mumbling to myself.
Just self-mumbling. Further questions? Mr. Drews, I want to ask you to stick around because I think there's going to be some adverse testimony and we're going to want to hear what you have to say in response to that if we could.
Sure.
Thank you. We have, just for the committee's information, we have quite a few witnesses signed up, some in favor, some opposed, some who've chose to remain mysterious as to whether they support or not, which is fine. That's what I would do, too. Sylvan Simmons, is that name right? Would you come up, please?
thought I was at the bottom of the list.
I'm sorry?
I thought I was at the bottom of the list.
Well, you were. One of the things I'm trying to do is to get the proponents of the bill first and then bring in the opponents and the folks with comments.
Okay. Representative Clark and committee members, I'm Sylvan Simmons. I know some of you have heard from me before, and I won't go through my complete life story here for you, at least not in this subcommittee, but I have included a copy of my testimony for your use. It's been very difficult for me to decide which of these bills to testify on because my family has been affected by every single issue you've addressed here. I represent many survivors and parents of survivors as I tell you my story. I'm going to tell you things today which I am sure will make you question my credibility and my ethics. Believe me, I do that myself. This is the ultimate risk for me, as you are the very people I hope to work with in changing these laws. I cannot be a sexual abuse advocate and not report my own mistakes and my own abuse. Today, I risk my family, my career, and my future in sharing these events. I have learned from many courageous survivors the freedom that comes from disclosure and confrontation. Even a year ago, I would not have dreamed that I would have had the courage to come before you today and disclose these facts. Please be compassionate and understand that although many survivors know better, we are unequipped to make wise decisions in all cases. Do not think that we do not feel shame, anger, and disgust at some of our own actions. Sometimes we can learn to make better choices. It is a lifetime process. I am the executive director of Stop It, Coalition Against Sexual Abuse. This organization was founded after many of us came together in testifying with the governor's task force hearings. I am also manager of the Resource Center operated by the Oregon chapter of the National Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse. These are both nonprofit community-based organizations with little or no funding. Therefore, I and others like me work as volunteers. You have before you there a packet of information, a packet of news articles from my son Gary's case as we spent 10 years in the courtroom with Boy Scouts of America. Gary gave us a small grant to start Stop It, which has now been all used up. But I feel like we've accomplished more in the short time that we've been organized than any organization that I know of.
Ms. Simmons, I'm going to stop you there if I could for just a minute and tell you that we have received your testimony, and I'm going to have to bring to you an uncomfortable concern, but there's no way around it. And that is, as I see your testimony, it looks like it's 9 or 10 pages.
No, I wasn't going to read all of it.
Okay, all right. I apologize. Yeah. We have it. I'm going to ask the committee specifically to make sure that you read it.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to Ms. Simmons as she summarizes her testimony. I wish we had time
to
hear it all, but we're going to have to review it and let you summarize it for us if you could.
Okay.
I just apologize. We're just under the clock.
No problem. The most important thing that I would like for you to notice as you look through the article that I gave you there is how many times this was reported and how many times that mandated reporters failed to act. That's the reason my son was awarded a very large settlement by Boy Scouts of America. I'm asking you today to consider that all of us have to be mandated reporters because so many times this was reported and no one acted on it. To me, it almost should be a felony for any of us that know of a child that's being abused and not to report it in some way. The final thing that I want to report to you today is the very last page of the very last paragraph of the very last page. You will notice in that page that during the course of my son's trial, that one of the sexual experts that came forward to work with my family also engaged in a sexual relationship with myself. In all of the abuse that I've experienced in my life, this was the most difficult and the most shameful that I've had to deal with. I want you to seriously consider requiring some certification for these people. They are out there walking the streets making megabucks, testifying and determining whether an offender walks or whether a child receives a settlement. Many of these people are totally unqualified, and some of them are even sick. So I'm asking you as a mother and an adult survivor and an adult survivor, please consider this bill. Thank you.
Ms. Simmons, one question. You mentioned these people at the end. You're talking about treatment specialists?
Treatment specialists. People that are purporting to be experts out there that have no training.
All right. First of all, I want to say we appreciate your testimony. Secondly, I'm going to ask you to stay there for a minute. I'm going to ask the committee to take 2 or 3 minutes to flip through the material that Ms. Simmons has given us and see if we have any questions for her. It's obviously a very powerful story, as you can tell from the news clippings. And but let's just stand at ease for a few minutes while we look through the material and see if there are questions. Ms. Simmons, we'll just ask you to hang tight for just a second. Testimony, I assume, applies to a number of the bills that we've been hearing over the last few weeks, and not just this one, although
no,
certainly
sir.
To this one.
It applies to almost everyone you've addressed and a few you haven't addressed.
Yeah, it's almost a case study of why each one of those bills is necessary. Are there questions for Ms. Simmons? Ms. Simmons, I know you've heard what I've said to some of the other witnesses who've come forward, and I want to repeat it again. I appreciate you coming forward. It takes enormous amounts of courage to come forward with personal stories, and we are always, I think, stunned is probably the best word, gratified that you're willing to come tell us your story, and we couldn't do what we're trying to do without hearing what happens out there. And I know it must have been especially difficult to sit here through several hearings knowing that you were going to testify and having that build up inside of you. So thank you very, very much.
Representative Clark and committee members, I would just like to thank you all on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. I represent many victims and many parents, and for some of us, this is the first time we've ever been heard. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Mary Hoyt, come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Hoyt, and I'm the chair of the Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children. I'm sorry I wasn't here at the beginning of the hearing, but Representative Courtney and I had to do a presentation at House Human Resources because they have two of the bills that we recommended. So I'm sorry. I just wanted to mention what we were trying to get at as a recommendation from the task force, that we have a number of people in the state who are mandated to report child abuse, and what we heard too frequently on our tours around the state is that many of these people, while they're mandated to report, they really don't have a good knowledge base or really a basic knowledge base about child abuse or sexual abuse. And so it's really very straightforward. We know there's difficulty when something is mandated. And I talked with a member representing the Oregon State Bar yesterday, and they have concerns with this. And I'd be happy to work with these groups around trying to get some clarifying language. But we felt it was very, very important that if people are required and mandated to report, that at least they have a basic information about the subject. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sanseri.
Who will be the licensing agency for this group, and what will be the criteria for the license, and how will we avoid... It was just mentioned in testimony before yours that there are some, quote, nuts, unquote, out there, sick people. How will we avoid licensing them and allowing them to continue with what they're doing only licensed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sensori, maybe I can separate my response. In this bill, 2397, we were really just looking at the people who are required to report child abuse. That's one thing. We also had concern, as Sylvan Simmons mentioned, that there are therapists or providers of programs that really we don't have the standards for the programs, and we don't have a certification process for the therapist, either treating victims or offenders. And we have a recommendation, and there's another bill in, and it's before another committee, I can't remember which one right now, that we're asking for an interim committee or task force just to work on developing the treatment standards and a certification process, because we feel, quite frankly, that there is a consumer protection issue here, and that is a growing industry, and we do have concerns about that, or we did as a task force.
Let me cut in for just a second, if necessary. What you're telling us is that the task force has come up with another bill that's gone to Human Resources and some other place that would create an interim task force to look at certification of sexual therapists.
Mm-hmm. As well as
the bill almost turned down.
Okay.
And that's separate from House Bill 2397, which is just saying that persons who are required to report, at least there be some evidence that they've had some basic training or knowledge about child sexual abuse.
Do you know what committee that's going to?
Mr. Chair, I think Labor, but I have to go look it up in the schedule. I have the number.
I think one went to Rules.
It may be Rules. I think you're
the
right.
Committee went
rules.
To that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what went to Rules.
Mm-hmm. It did. You're right. Rules
well,
and
that
not
makes
Labor.
Sense. I know that there are a couple of members of the subcommittee who would like to go testify in favor of that bill. And so if you would let council know where that bill is coming to.
Be happy to.
I think there are several members of the subcommittee who would like to go testify on that. Further questions for Ms. Hoyt? Council.
Just a question. Mary, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
Yes, I do.
There's language on line 15 of the printed bill that talks about persons regulated by the board who in their official capacity have regular and ongoing contact with children. It took much discussion to get that language negotiated last session in terms of limiting the numbers of individuals who would have to subsequently be notified about the duty to report. Did the task force have any discussion about using that same language or trying to limit the pool in the same way that the notification requirements are limited already?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Robinson, no, we didn't. We did have some discussion during our task force meetings among the attorneys on the task force, and somebody say, oh, did you ever see any notification? Oh, yeah, I think there must have been something. But they hadn't been very conscious of the notification, so I thought that was interesting.
Well, it was about an inch-by-inch box, and for the record, about a month after session was over, and if you didn't flip it over when you got it in the mail, you probably wouldn't have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, be that as it may, was there because the notification, as this bill is written, and as I misread it initially, the people that have to get notice of the duty to report is much broader, I mean, it's much narrower than those that have to be trained.
You're right. I think you're right.
Was mm-hmm. that your intent?
No, I don't. We didn't have a discussion about that. It was just the big picture of saying anyone who's...
So those that are getting noticed ought to correspond with those that are being trained.
Yes, that would work just fine.
That's helpful.
Mm-hmm. That would be fine with us.
Further questions? Representative Maddox, did you have a question? I thought you did.
I did before, actually. First question is, in regard to the statute here and the new language that we'd be putting in regarding the certification of training, shouldn't we expand that to be not just child sexual abuse, but add the phrase and child abuse?
That would be, Mr. Chair, that would be fine with us. We were just focusing on the sex abuse.
Secondly, I assume that the bar can provide some of this training in terms of mandatory legal education programs where lawyers have to get credits every year and everything. I'm concerned about us coming at this sort of backwards. We're going to say all these organizations are going to require evidence of the training. Is it because we're having difficulty coming forward and just saying, here's the training and you must take this training, or we want to give them a variety of training sources? Why have we come at it that way and just said, well, you've got to bring evidence of training. This is the new provision.
Well, I'm having a difficult time.
All right. The bill says you've got to come in with evidence of training.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't we just set up a training program and tell everybody they have to take that training program?
Oh, I think Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, what we were thinking of initially is that we knew that Children's Services was developing some curriculum and that could be shared, and then the organizations that license or certify professionals could just use that and use whatever mechanism they have available currently, either in service through the schools or continuing ed days, and they could use that material. And we just thought it would be easy rather than trying to develop a whole training site or program.
Follow up on that? Well, my next concern then is we're saying you have to provide this evidence of training. There's somewhere around 8,000 lawyers in the state now.
10, I believe.
10,000 lawyers now. Maybe 1,000 of them are regularly involved with children. For instance, in my practice, since I left the Attorney General's office, I don't deal with children's issues. I deal with litigation and insurance. And are we overdoing it if we say all of those people have to provide certification of training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I think that was the issue that Ms. Robinson was getting at, and that is with the language that maybe narrows.
One considerable comment has been made regarding the lack of training as it relates to the failure to report. We are very concerned about the failure to report, and this was an issue that, spending a number of years as a school district personnel director, I had to deal with, as people would call and say, do you think I need to report this? And the best I could do would be to read the law and say, if it fits, yes, you do need to report it. I am concerned that it is sometimes the political sensitivity of the issue rather than lack of understanding that leads people not to report when reports should have been made. Now, maybe adequate training will solve that problem.
That's a very interesting comment. What do you mean by that?
I think the lady from Sisters described essentially political situations.
Okay. I said I was going to ask the panel to wait to ask questions, and I didn't do that. Go ahead.
I'm not exactly sure how the education community fits in to the proposed language. For those public or private officials who are not licensed, there is one provision. Those people are not now notified, but this would include not all, but most of our classified or non-certificated employees do deal with children. So I assume they would come under that provision. The last sentence in the bill, I assume, would refer to the certificated staff. Again, we have a kind of awkward situation. They're like the nurses, our certificated staff has no continuing professional development requirement. As a matter of fact, that is forbidden, as far as teachers are concerned, by state statute. We would be very pleased to join with others to talk about this bill and to see what we could bring out of it in terms of programs that would be workable and helpful.
Thank you. Mr. Myers from the bar, do you have anything to add to those comments? I know you weren't prepared to testify and we sort of drafted you, but would you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Carl Myers, an attorney practicing in Salem, appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. Let me say that the Oregon State Bar fully endorses the concept of this bill. From a practical point of view, I might point out we have some difficulty in identifying the people who may be subject to this. I might also point out at this point that I have with me Jerry Banks from the board of the Mandatory Continuing Legal Education. So if the committee has questions about MCLE and its applications, I'd certainly be happy to have him here. But as you know, the Bar Association is comprised of over 10,000 lawyers, and rough estimates would put perhaps 90% of those lawyers do not come in contact with children or be subject to the notice. We do have the family law section, the juvenile law section, but those are not mandatory sections, so even if you practice in that area, you may not necessarily be a member of that section. And as I said, a great number of lawyers, as Chairman Clark pointed out, tax lawyers, patent lawyers, and a number of others would probably not come under the purview of this CLE. The bar has chosen to send its notice to all lawyers, simply telling them that if they do come in contact, they have the duty to report. The problem that the bar has with this bill is how do we enforce that, since we do not know those lawyers who come in contact. We have no way to check that off against those who attend the CLEs. The mandatory CLE folks are willing to get together with whomever and offer classes, but it probably is going to have to be on some kind of voluntary basis from the bar's point of view. Let the lawyers, him or herself, stand up and participate if they do qualify here. That is our problem from a realistic and application point of view.
All right, questions for the panel there, and then the chair has an idea that I'm going to try and float and see which way the committee wants to go. Representative Mannix.
Well, I'd like to switch back to Mr. Gallant I noticed that a couple of years ago, Senator Jeanette Hamby had a bill that was going to require that any woman who was going to undergo a hysterectomy have an opportunity to be, in fact, there was a requirement that she get a second opinion, something along those lines. In reaction to that, the Medical Association said, well, this may be ludicrous. There may be many circumstances where that would not be appropriate. And said, if you're worried about the objective, which is informed consent and understanding what the hysterectomy is all about, let's put together a pamphlet that all physicians can provide to their patients, something that's worked up by a task force. And I know the reason I know about it is because I got a copy. You were very nice to send us a mailing a couple of weeks ago. And I was impressed about how a group of people put together a pamphlet on a voluntary basis that made sure that all women undergoing hysterectomies would be fully advised about it. Now, drawing from that, if our objective is to make sure as many people as possible who have active contact with kids are able to identify and then know their obligation to report child abuse and child sexual abuse, are we going about it sort of at the end of the spectrum by saying, well, here we're going to say you must provide documentation of your education. At the other end, we've said, well, Children's Services, with their limited resources, are going to put together a program and curriculum and, yeah, here it is and here it is, but in the big middle, we're not reaching out to all those people and making sure that the programs are being effectively run. How do you react to the idea that was posed before Mr. Myers stepped in the room of asking for an informal task group to come together with some educational formats, short, medium, and long, that could be devised? It's a good standardized education program, and then encourage all of these organizations out there to provide that training, some mechanism to do that.
Mr. Chairman, if I may react
Mr. Gallant.
To that. Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. I think the first thing that you really need to assess, and the department may already have it, I think would be an evaluation or a catalog of what resources are currently available. It doesn't make a lot of sense to duplicate something that may be, in fact, available and very, very good. As I mentioned on Health Sciences University, 33 lectures were put on, and there may be materials from that or from other sources. The point of getting the people who are interested in this issue together to kind of maybe figure out what is available and where the greatest need is, I think would be very useful for everyone, including the subcommittee, and we'd be willing to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
The issue from last session, it was actually a separate informed consent, written and oral informed consent, that we had problems with.
Okay. Representative Edmondson.
Let's cut to the chase. Each of the three of you answer this question. Are training programs in Oregon today adequate?
It is my... Mr. Chairman, Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association, and I've only had a couple of days to try to catch up to speed on this particular issue. It's my understanding that there are programs available to physicians, particularly physicians who deal with children who may be abused, to teach them how to identify, et cetera, et cetera. I doubt if those programs are going on the Hill or otherwise for family practice physicians, emergency room physicians, or otherwise if they weren't adequate.
So your answer is yes?
My answer is a yes.
Next. Mr. Benninghoff.
Mr. Chair, Joe Benninghoff with COSA, I do not know.
Fair enough.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, Carl Myers on behalf of the bar, I don't know either. Whether they're satisfactory or not, I guess, depends on your point of view. What might be a satisfactory program for lawyers in our case in this area may not be satisfactory from CSD or somebody else's point of view, and that's the bar is certainly willing to work with those groups to develop a curriculum for lawyers as part of a program for them.
Thank you.
Okay, one last question, Representative Mason, and then we're going to have to move on to two last questions.
It's not so much a question as an observation. I think that when it particularly comes to the bar and to a certain extent the medical side, you realize, and I don't think it's been articulated here today, and I apologize for not being here the whole time, but you realize you're going to run smack dab into the confidentiality client confidentiality situation, and I can't tell you exactly where and how, but you're going to.
I think, Representative Mason, that those battles, if I'm not mistaken, were fought last session with the reporting requirement itself. I think it's an issue that continues to be.
We'll have the battle again with another bill on reporting.
Kind of worked out in the.
If I might, and it's a battle I'm willing to fight because I think if anything and may raise the hackles of my brothers and sisters in the bar. I think that the attorney-client confidentiality thing has been overemphasized, and having sat through one of our ethics CLEs, I was impressed by how little ethics had to do with it. But it's going to be there when you confront this issue. You're really going to have to. It's really going to be there. Maybe Representative Mannix does have a good bill along this line, but you know what I'm talking about here.
Representative Bauman.
Yeah, it is also kind of a comment, and I'm just unable to sit here and listen without having a real reaction. You haven't sat through what this committee has sat through, and you must know that breathing down the backs of your neck right now is a group of people who are many of them have been here and have presented us with some training, which I've never received as a member of the bar or as a member or as a former school teacher or as a member of the public. Now, there's something seriously the matter here. And either there is a political movement on and the committee is being just absolutely taken in by it, because I think the majority of us believe that there really is a child abuse problem and that it really is connected to school failure and that it really is connected to criminal behavior and that it really is connected to family dysfunction that then keeps that cycle going. A real problem, right? Now, and it's all of our responsibility. But maybe it's not a real problem, because when it comes to taking responsibility for it in the professions, and the three of you represent the most highly honored professions in our society, doctors, lawyers, and teachers, those three professions are saying, now, wait a minute. I'm not really exposed to this problem, or it's really not a big enough problem, or not out of my pocket. And I'm upset about it, because these people behind you, and you all need rearview mirrors, are upset, and they're victims. And they have me upset now, and we're turning to you and the people that you represent and who we all have been trained to admire. And I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I'd like to.
There's a denial. We've got a denial problem.
I may respond to that observation.
Mr. Gallant.
My testimony did not say that this was not a real problem. I did not indicate that the association didn't realize how serious it was. The people who I represent treat the individuals that we are discussing. They are obligated to report. They go to educational seminars on this issue. And I don't believe that, the characterization, at least that my testimony indicated that we are indifferent to this particular issue, is fair nor appropriate characterization. What I did say was, is I think it would be wise and smart to do an appropriate assessment of what is currently available, assess a targeted need for those who ought to be better trained. If that includes physicians, that is fine. That there might, in fact, be a different approach to this particular bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gallant. Thank you, Representative Bauman. Let me offer a suggestion. I learned a trick last session serving on committees under Representative Bauman and Representative Mason, and it's the extended go out in the hallway idea. And she was able to make it work with groups as diverse as migrant farm workers and Columbia Gorge fruit farmers. And so we ought to be able to do something here. What I'm going to do is ask that the three of you, if you're able and willing, work with the proponents of the bill and with Representative Edmondson on a working group to come back and make recommendations for amendments to the bill in about 3 weeks, if that's going to work with everyone's schedule. I'm concerned that we're going to lose the gentleman from Sacred Heart Hospital to Kenya here pretty quickly. And I'm afraid if we don't have our work done, that several of the members of the working group will go with him to Kenya.
Wouldn't have a vote, though.
I'm sorry?
They wouldn't have a vote if they did.
That's right. If you go to Kenya, you lose your spot on the working committee. And ask that you come back with recommendations for amendments for us. And let me try and give you a little specificity from what I understand to be the sense of the committee. I think a majority of the committee is concerned about the open-endedness of the bill as it now stands. And I think we can still do something very, very meaningful while we try and make sure that people who legitimately are not in contact with children don't come under the provision of this bill. I don't know whether they're going to be able to do that or not, but that ought to be one of the goals, is to try and make sure that people who simply aren't exposed to children are not under the mandatory training requirements. That's one concern that I've heard. The other concern, I think, is fairly unanimous that perhaps the sexual abuse limitation is inappropriate, and the bill might want to be expanded in that regard. The content, the folks from Sacred Heart Hospital brought up a very important point that I think the committee seized on about the quality of the training and what goes into it. As far as the question of whether this should be voluntary or mandatory, I will just say this from the standpoint of the chair. Whatever it is, better work. Because if we put it into place on a voluntary basis, which I might be willing to consider, I don't know that, I might be willing to consider that, and the committee might be willing to consider that. I can't speak for the committee at this time. But if we put it into place on a voluntary basis and it doesn't work in 2 years, there will be a mandatory bill. So it better work from my perspective, and I hope I'm not overspeaking my authority on behalf of the committee. We very much appreciate the concerns you bring to us, the expertise you bring to us. I believe all of you when you say that you recognize the problem. And so we will ask you to work with Representative Edmondson. Any other member of the subcommittee that would like to work on that task force is more than welcome to do that, as well as with the proponents of the bill, and bring us back some recommendations in 3 weeks or a month.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bell.
I have a question that maybe we should ask before they take on the task. In on line 6, where it says, other than law enforcement officers, does that exclude them through the whole bill?
That's existing law.
Other training requirements.
Yeah, they have other training.
They are trained through BPST and other places.
Okay, I guess I would like us to review that because of the testimonies we've received, rural law enforcement officers have been some of the worst offenders as far as treatment and care of abuse victims.
That's a good point. We'll ask for some further testimony on that point. Any questions from you, gentlemen? Yes, sir, Mr. Benninghoff.
Mr. Chair, Joe Benninghoff, I did not come representing the entire education community, but there are a couple of other players, the Oregon School Boards Association, and I am hesitant to say I represent the Oregon Education Association, but we'll say that.
It's nothing like John Daniels.
would you want them included in this?
Certainly would want them invited if they choose not to. Right.
I'm not sure if school board members may be direct.
Right.
Administrators and
right.
professionals.
Right. Yeah. And like I say, I encourage any other member of the subcommittee that would like to be involved in this process to contact Representative Edmondson, and we'll be very interested in hearing what you have to say.
Mr.
And we appreciate your willingness to take part in that. Yes,
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Bauman.
I'd like to say that I feel somewhat chastised by Mr. Gallant, and I appreciate that, and I think I may have landed on all of you, and you may feel landed on, and that's intentional. And it's not a problem that you created. But I have to impress on you in a short time and invite you to sit in on more of these meetings when we go over these bills that the task force came up with. That we're talking about the whole future generation of Oregonians, many of whom, as Representative Courtney says, are, you know, crying themselves to sleep at night. And they are our responsibility, and I think they're our responsibility whether we're a tax attorney or a criminal defense attorney or a trial attorney or a pediatrician or a school administrator. You know, or whatever. So I would come from a position that it is a broad problem at this point due to none of our faults, but it's all of our responsibility, and I think that we have the power in this room to do something to address it. I think we have to deal with it sternly.
Thank you, Representative Bauman. Thank you, members of the committee, and I want to thank the witnesses. We are going to, I'm going to do the following. We're going to take a five-minute recess, and we'd like to visit with the members of the subcommittee to find out what each person's time constraints are this afternoon. We would like very much to get to House Bill 2395 and work that, as well as take some testimony. And so I need to visit with each of you individually on what your time constraints are. We'll take a five-minute recess, come back with House Bill 2395 at 4 o'clock. And we will move into what?
We can take care of another bill quickly. We're just 2415.
What do we need to move on it?
I think we can go into work session.
I didn't even bring that bill. I don't believe it. 24,
2542,
are we supposed to
do that? Well, it's just some info on it. So it's already been passed out by Chronic Corrections.
All right, we'll move into work session on House Bill 2395. I'm going to ask Mr. Gardner to come up, please. Is he around? Okay. We will mumble for a little bit while we're waiting for him.
Yeah.
While we're waiting for Mr. Gardner, we'll ask Dr. Benson Schaefer. We did, didn't we? Didn't we close the... We're doing two things at once. We can't do that. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2397, open the work session on House Bill 2395, and ask Dr. Benson Schaefer and Chuck Bennett to come up. Oh, there they are.
We are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will find in your packet on this bill some information which I would like to walk the committee through. We are not neatly stapled together today, so bear with me while I... this one is, actually. The committee will recall that we began hearings on the hearsay exception bill at the end of January,
And there were a couple of issues raised at that time. One of them had to do with whether or not Oregon statute would probably withstand constitutional muster given the case of Idaho versus Wright. In reading that and rereading Oregon statutes, I think that the committee is in fine shape vis-a-vis the requirements of the U.S. Supreme Court. There are some issues that Mr. Gardner would like to raise, and if the committee wants me to walk through the bill a little bit, I will be happy to. I think that the reason that Mr. Bennett and Mr. Schaefer here is the following. When the committee considered this issue last session and drafted the massive revisions to the evidence code that created the hearsay exception and created a new exception made by statements made by children under 10 and created a new exception rather than the residual exception, one of the issues that was raised at that time was that many of the initial statements are made to persons other than doctors, persons like social workers who are investigating the case, teachers, and treating therapists. And there was a discussion at that time, which I think Mr. Bennett would like to continue, about whether or not it is appropriate to reconsider whether or not statements that were made by a child to a psychotherapist for purposes of treatment or diagnosis insofar as treating child abuse would be appropriate for the committee's consideration. In your packet, you will see something called Proposed Amendment to 2395. What I have done is looked at the language that the committee developed last session and that was in the House bill last session, let me just read it to the committee, and then Dr. Schaefer and Mr. Bennett can respond to it. I did this, and I apologize to the witnesses because I did it and didn't show it to them.
Counsel, this is in the packet behind Mr. Gardner's proposed draft.
Correct. The language that appeared in last session's bill said statements made by a child under 10 years of age to a psychotherapist as defined in ORS 40.230. And if you turn back up the next page, you will see that language and you will see who is included in that list. And then I, as an alternative, because this was also discussed last session, was statements made to persons licensed under ORS Chapter 675, which includes psychologists, clinical social workers, and licensed marriage and family therapists, just to give the committee some sense of who is licensed to do this kind of thing for the purposes of diagnosis or treatment of mental or emotional disorders, insofar as those statements are reasonably pertinent to that diagnosis or treatment. This is comparable to what the House version of this bill had in last session and what, at Mr. Bennett's request, I put together for the committee's consideration.
Thank you very much, counsel. Dr. Schaefer, Mr. Bennett, we're in work session, and so we will ask you to limit your comments to that proposed amendment and anything that you can kind of reasonably hook into that. You're welcome to do that, too.
Okay. Chair Clark, Counsel Robinson, members of the committee, thanks for having me. My name is Benson Schaefer. I'm a child psychologist. I work with kids with problems, all sorts of kids, normal, retarded, impaired in some other way, kids who've been abused physically, sexually, all sorts of situations. I'm here to basically, now that I've heard it, agree with Counsel Robinson in terms of defining how to extend the hearsay testimony. Let me then tell you some reasons why I think this should be the case. For the most part, the majority of evidence here is probably not given solely to physicians or any particular class of people, but rather to those who are most likely to deal with the problem of sexual abuse, social workers, psychologists, licensed counselors. And these people are trained to deal with the problem. The problems that the children experience are, in fact, psychological in nature. Let me give you just a couple of instances. I was working with a young boy who at the time was 5. He was molested by a family member, an adolescent cousin. had he had to testify, this would have been extremely hard on him. He had not spoken to any physicians about it. He had not spoken to any lawyers, and he wouldn't have. His mother had spoken indirectly to me, and I had spoken to him. And that's the way it came up. I think that's only one particular instance, and I think a lot of things happen that way. Also, as you may well know, CSD often mandates evaluations of possible sexual abuse, and psychologists are asked to do those evaluations. Therefore, I think they should be allowed to testify. I would like to ask for one possible other consideration here. This says, extends the hearsay exception to for statements by a child victim of sexual conduct and the child is under 10. There are often victims of sexual conduct who are developmentally disabled, who are over 10, who are functionally 10 or under. And I think some words would be, it would be good to put in some words to deal with that situation, that is to extend the hearsay exception to older developmentally disabled individuals, because the pressures on them of testifying in court are the same as those on
which, as I understand it, is not an infrequent occurrence because
not
of their vulnerability.
Right. In fact, I was recently working with a case like that. So,
actually, a higher incidence.
Yeah, that would make sense. All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
Now, which version would you support? We have two versions of language here. One is broader than the other, and I may have missed this particular fine point.
The one I'm supporting is, in particular, which includes psychologists, clinical social workers, and licensed marriage and family therapists.
So we'd use the Chapter 675 language there.
All right,
thank
yes.
you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix.
Learned counsel.
Let me just point out why I did this, and there was a reason why I tried to look through an alternative, and I think it's particularly germane given the conversation today. If you look on page 410, it says a psychotherapist means a person who is licensed, registered, certified, or otherwise authorized by the laws of the state to engage in the diagnosis, or B, reasonably believed by the patient to be while so engaged. And given the testimony that this committee has had, and the fact that we do